Okay, the other group will be coming in, but why don't we just get started in the interest of moving this along? We've just, in the interest of those of you who are listening on the internet, we've just given everybody a copy of the case called Bounce Energy Systems. We divided the group into different pods, and now we're going to ask one representative of each pod to sort of say, what did the group decide they would do? So how about your group? Who's the spokesperson?
I'll go ahead and speak for us.
Okay, so please.
Brian Wagner here. So we collectively discussed the case, and there's a lot of information that we don't have at our disposal, so we made a variety of different assumptions. They could be wrong, but in the end, we felt it important to understand and ultimately manage everyone's incentives, and their incentives are different. You know, Sherry's at Bain's is one, certainly Jeffrey's is another, and then the independent director that has just joined is kind of caught in the middle. So to better understand that and to not make rash decisions that potentially could destroy shareholder value for all involved, we thought it would be best to have separate conversations with Sherry and Jeff, letting them know that we probably need to hire an outside consultant to obtain data and fact and bring forward a recommendation that's not based upon emotion and really determine, is this a 4-year exit or is it a 9-year exit? And if so, why? And what are the information that would support either of that? You know, state to Sherry that this really isn't a decision amongst her and Jeff. It's a full board decision. So we as a board need to capture everybody's input and ultimately their endorsement. And therefore, it's our recommendation that we bring forward to the board. This is the contentious issue. We feel our recommendation to address it is to hire an outside consultant, certainly avoid that higher group and struggles $100,000 plus fee, and have them really bring forward an independent recommendation. And, you know, in the end, based upon that recommendation, we feel it's prudent just to go hire Larry and have him tell us what to do.
All right, they win. All right, how about your group over here?
Okay. Well, like Brian's team, we looked at this from the perspective of this incoming director. And there are three problems. First problem is the communication problem. The second problem is the perceived bandwidth of Jeffrey on both managing company day-to-day and the addition of new companies and the roll-up. And the third is just an understanding of the market. And there seems to be at least two perceptions of the market between the investment director and the acting CEO. And our view was that as the incoming director, that you had the opportunity and the responsibility to say no to Sherry, that you would not give a mandate, that what you wanted was time to work with Jeffrey and work with the VP of sales. And mission one would be to look at the sales problem and the marketing problem. While you're doing that, you're establishing a relationship with Jeffrey, and you can begin to look at his ability to do roll-ups and manage a broader company.
Okay. 13.
So we looked at the question: should we offer to help out Sherry? And seeing as we're a CFO, we question whether we're the right person to get involved with this. So, not sure a CFO would be the right person to be the chairman of the board of a company in this situation. But putting that aside, if we did step in, we thought a good approach would be to, given Jeffrey, evidently, if we assume that Jeffrey is not stepping up to the plate on the plan that needs to be executed, sit down with Jeffrey, talk about what he likes to do, what he doesn't want to do, get him on board with taking a role that's more suited to what he enjoys doing, move to a CTO CEO, let the new CEO look at the media sales. I would, if we calm down here and see if things happen by Friday.
Okay. So we have different, we didn't have a consensus, the groups.
Summary of the answer here?
We didn't.
Hire Larry.
No. In other words, the right answer.
No. Our recommendation was very similar, but at a different approach. We felt that we didn't have enough fact, information, data. This is a lot of emotion here. You as the new independent, you're completely new, so you don't know what you don't know. We agree that letting go of the salesperson in a day or two is not the right thing, could destroy shareholder value. So we felt we should have side conversations, both with Sherry and Jeff, explain to them that this isn't a independent decision that would be made amongst just them, but it's a full board decision. And in order, we need to bring the full board together. We need to raise this as an issue, really determine, is this a 4-year exit or is it a 9? And if so, why, based upon fact and data? The best way to get to that is through a consultant to be independent, to come in and provide that for us, and then make the determination, do we, with the input and buy-in of Sherry and Jeff, along with the consultant, maybe have him become the CTO, maybe bring in a CEO, because it's not 4, it's not 9, but it's 7, and neither one were right, but that's the plan we're going with, and in order to do that, we do need a new CEO, potentially, or not. Maybe Jeffrey's right, maybe this is a 9-year thing based upon the data that is readily available. But that's the process we would recommend going through, because that would bring both along in a constructive way, as opposed to, I think it was mentioned earlier, there's lack of communication here. There's total communication problem.
How many have been involved in a scenario somewhat like this, where you have a founder, or it could be a family, the owner of a family business, it's been acquired or invested in by an outsider, and you've got these clashes. How many have been involved in? So wow. This case is not
far-fetched.
Unique. It's really an archetype case. So what I'd like to do is to talk about how important is this issue, how common is this issue, what are the typical ways that private equity companies try to deal with it, and then some suggestions for how private equity and how you as board members can help deal with it. First, let's deal with the importance. In 2015, Ben Nazarin of Triple Point Ventures and Michael Abbott of Kleiner Perkins examined 1,195 PE transactions that occurred between 1994 and 2014. So most of these transactions would be either mergers or they would be an IPO. They gave the company a 1 if the CEO at the time of the transaction was the founder. They gave the company 0 if the CEO was not the founder. They found that founder CEOs raised more capital than professional managers. They found that founders produced higher valuation. Their conclusion? Founders generate more value for private equity firms. Is this unique? A year later, in 2016, Chris Zug and James Allen of Bain Consulting published The Founder's Mentality. This is the book you and I were talking about. They looked at a totally different database of larger public companies, and they found that Since 1990, we found the returns to shareholders in public companies where the founder is still involved are 3 times higher than in other companies. Think about that. You could create a mutual fund just composed of founders who are running the company. As the founders leave or die or get incapacitated, like Sumner Redstone, you just sell and then move on to something else. The result is you want to keep your founders. Well, not really. Gong and Wu looked at 126 private equity transactions between 1990 and 2016. They documented a CEO turnover rate of 51% within 2 years of the private equity acquisition. According to the authors, the removals of the founders were all around the CEOs having lost the confidence of the private equity dominated board. It was not related to the company having outgrown the CEO. Bain and Company agrees. They said that founders who cannot or will not scale up results in their removal only one out of every three times. So it's not the scale up issues. So why is this important? One is when you take a founder or family business owner and then remove them, you're creating turmoil and uncertainty for customers. You're creating opportunities for your competitors. You're creating turmoil and uncertainty for employees. And then, of course, after the employment contract is expired, you've now groomed your competitor. And remember, there was a reason the private equity firm made the investment to begin with, and one of those reasons was the founder. Now, what makes founders so special? This is important, and it's the Zug and Allen book, The Founder's Mentality. What they say is, there are three attributes of successful founders. One is they consider themselves insurgents. In other words, they go in and they say, the accepted way of doing things is wrong. I've got a better way. We're going to change industry practices. We're going to change the world. Again, think about the classic founder, Steve Jobs. He always needed an enemy to fight against. He always needed to be the insurgents. And when he was at the top, he still needed to consider himself a surgeon. Second, obsessed with the details of their business. Obsessed with it and focused on the front line of the business. The front line could be R&D. The front line could be the customers. But they're obsessed with the front line, whatever the front line is. And the final thing is that they have an owner's mindset. And they infect the other employees to have an owner's mindset. So those are the three attributes. Insurgent mentalities, obsessive focus on the front line, an owner's mindset, and they affect the employees. So you want to scale up. And you replace the founder with a professional CEO. What have you accomplished? Well, you bring somebody who's more financially oriented, who's more focused on the bottom line. You get deterioration of morale and the creation of a bureaucracy. And the bureaucracy tends to be more focused on internal issues than external issues. The key in scaling is how do you scale and keep the founder's mentality at the same time. I will illustrate this with two examples, one from the book and one from my own personal experience. The first is Home Depot. Home Depot was founded by Arthur Blank and Bernie Marcus. They were the founders, they were the entrepreneurs, and they were insurgents. They thought the traditional way of hardware was leaving the buyer confused and dazed, and the buyer doesn't want to buy a product, he wants to buy a product and a solution. So they would hire people for full-time jobs who were contractors and give them full-time jobs with full-time benefits, and your job was whatever it takes to help that customer do it at home. Your job is not to sell them the product, it's to help them do it at home. These are home fixer-upper type people. You could see Bernie and Arthur, they would do training programs for the front line. They would run seminars for customers. The front line was the customer. Between 1978 and 2000, Home Depot eclipsed its 20% annual growth targets. Then in 2000, the company had a hiccup. It missed its targets, and the board got rid of the two founders. They brought in professional management, in this case, Bob Nardelli, who had been at General Electric most of his life. And everybody knew Bob Nardelli as a classic, good GE-trained, Harvard Business School kind of guy. He was gonna shake this up. So first things he does is he gets rid of the whatever it takes culture. And by the way, why should you pay all this money for this help? He fires the employees and replaces them with less trained part-time help. Soon, morale goes down to hell. The costs go down, but the quality of service goes down. By 2006, the University of Michigan released its annual American Customer Satisfaction Index. Home Depot was dead last among U.S. retailers. It was 11 points behind Lowe's. It had 4 years of declining foot traffic, and market value had declined by 55%. Eventually, the company replaced Nardelli with Frank Blake. And this is the interesting thing. He was not an entrepreneur, but he tapped into the founder's mentality and got it back again. And that's the important thing. You don't need to be the founder, but if you can tap into the founder's mentality, then you can do it, and that's what they did. I'll give you another example from my own personal experience. I was the coach to the CEO of one of America's most well-known public resort companies. This is a company that owns hotels all over the world. This person was the founder of this. You know, when you go to those hotels and they say, how was your stay? You know, check the thing, you know, with the card. Guess what? He would read every card. He had a way of knowing who was in their club, you know, in their frequent flyer program. He would read every one of those. But if you came in through hotels.com, he didn't care. So he's only reading the ones but he read every one. And if he saw a problem, he would make a call to the local hotel person. I would follow him to the hotels. All of his questions was on the customer experience. He would go around, he would go into such details of why are those roses planted there, it doesn't fit, you really need these kinds of flowers. So he'd get into the real weeds about the customer experience. For him, everything was the customer experience. Long story short, the board turns on him, fires him, replaces him with a Harvard Business School president, not CEO, but president of one of America's great consumer products company, a fabulous marketing person. And I followed him as he would go around. He didn't care about any of the things that the founder cared about. He only asked one thing. What's the occupancy rate? He was only focusing on the financial ends of things, but didn't particularly care or know about the customer experience. He wasn't involved in that. Company went nowhere and is currently being acquired. So that's a personal experience. Now, what do most companies do? Yep.
Share with you something that I read recently. I can't remember the title of the book, but it's about a guy who, his career, I think maybe CIA, spent much of his career in Vietnam pre the U.S. incursion, and was focused on understanding the mentality of the Viet Cong. And what he said was the problem with the American experience was basically how you just described what went on here. They were trying to run the war by the metrics. What was his name? McNamara was strictly a numbers guy. I think he came from Ford, the financial, the CFO, excuse me, Tony. they had no sense of the mentality of the VC. The VC were totally willing to face death. They were almost like, you know, these suicide bombers in the Middle East, and the Americans never got it. They did not understand that. They didn't want to listen to people that brought that up. The book was about the conflict of these two senior strategists, one who became an accolade of Richard Nixon's famous Secretary of State,
Kissinger.
Kissinger.
Kissinger, yeah. And fascinating that what you describe in terms of corporate success and failure happens on the big stage too.
You see this over and over again. Now, what do most private equity companies do? I'm going to give you an example from a book called Elizabeth the Queen by Sally Bedell Smith, and it's about the reign of Queen Elizabeth II. And there's a scene where Princess Diana has just married Charles. And the Queen says, "You know, your life is going to change forever now that you are a royal, but I want you to know that I'm here to help. So please call on me anytime." Intentions are really good. You got to give the Queen credit, her intentions are good. But the design of the intervention was flawed in three ways. Number one is, the Queen is saying, "I'm here to help." Well, if Diana has a problem, what are the problems going to be? The problems will be the Queen or the Queen's son. Second is, I'm here to help and I'm the Queen. How accessible is the Queen of England? She's got a life, she's got busy things. Third is, Diana is young, she just married Prince Charles, she could be the future Queen of England, she's full of herself. How likely is she going to pick up the phone and say to the Queen, "I need help"? It's the same structure in the private equity world. Congratulations, I've just bought 51% of your company, I really believe in you, I know that things are going to change, but listen, I'm here to help, call me. Three things wrong with that. If he has a problem, the problem's going to be me. How can I consult with him about me? Two, am I accessible? I'm probably on 8 boards, plus I love doing transactions and I hate doing coaching. And third, he just got a big check from me and he's full of himself. He thinks he knows it all. Is he going to pick up the phone and call me? Probably not. So it's the same issue. Good intentions, flawed design. So here are a couple of suggestions. First is, the entrepreneur is going to need help to unlearn past habits of success. I know from when I was young and stupid, I thought learning was really tough. Now that I'm certifiably old and stupid, I realize learning is not as difficult as I thought. It's unlearning that's the real tough part. For example, suppose you were asked to sign a check with your non-dominant hand. I'm sure all of you know what the steps are and could articulate what the steps are. The problem is you can't do it. You've got so much success signing it this way that suddenly signing it this way is not only awkward, but for many of you, it's going to be nearly impossible. Unlearning is very difficult, and particularly unlearning success. So one of the things in the case was what we call the problem-solved problem. When you have a family business owner or a founder of a business and he's got a family-dominated business or a founder-dominated board of directors, one of the ways to successfully manage that board is with the problem-solved problem, which is, look, there was a company representing 45% of our sales and they were going to go to a competitor. I flew down to Caracas, I talked with them, I wined them, I dined them, I got them to change their mind and they're back with us. You say that to a founder-dominated board and they're going to go, "Whew, boy, I'm sure glad you're here. That's one less problem I got to deal with." You say that to a family-dominated board, they're going to say, "Whew, glad you're here." You say that to a private equity-dominated board, and the reaction is going to be, "You bastard. There was a crisis, and you didn't tell me about it, and you left me in the dark until it's all over. I wonder what else you're leaving me in the dark with." And now you're starting to circle the drain. Not because you're evil, but because you did what works so well with a founder-dominated board. And that was in this case. How do you identify predictable let me give you another example from our work. A young man from MIT, brilliant, he's president of a company and a top-tier private equity company is now, or venture capital is now invested in him. His goal is to grow the business. I'm working with him and he's got to make his presentation to the board. And what he's done is he's developed this Gantt chart that's going to take 25 minutes to explain of all the different steps that he's doing to rent space, to hire people. And again, any CFO would love this because it really gets into the weeds. And I'm saying, you know, you're a prisoner of your own success. Your attention to detail and your thoroughness is one of the reasons you did so well in MIT and you are doing so well in R&D. But this is a board of directors. Here's what this board is concerned with. The board fears that your mission in life is to build the world's best mousetrap. And this board only wants you to build the world's best good enough mousetrap that we can sell it to General Electric. And you have to convince them that you understand their sense of urgency and you share their sense of urgency. Well, how do I do that? I said, okay, the magic word is urgency. And I want you to use the word urgent as often as possible. And I don't want you to show the Gantt chart. I just want you to say, I understand your urgency about hiring 16 people. I understand your urgency about getting the office space. I want you to know I'm in discussions with real estate agents who are looking at 3 sites and we've hired 3 recruiters and I share your sense of urgency. And he looks at me and says, I was preparing this for 20 minutes and you got it down to 8 seconds. You're telling me this board will buy that? And I said, yeah. So he says it, 8 seconds, board smiles and moves on. Again, this is not rocket science, but you're dealing with incredibly bright, successful people who are used to being successful, doing it a certain way, and the dynamics of a private equity board are not the same as the dynamics of a founder-dominated board. So it's just, how do you learn the territory? We have a Psychology Today article that Marianne and I wrote, and that part of it deals with these issues. But the other thing that we did is that we went to some private equity partners and said, what, in order to help founders unlearn their success, what do they have to know and what do they have to understand? And so they came up with a list of, here's what you got to do. So I'll share that with you. Now, let me just shut up and say, any comments, questions, concerns, or anything that we've talked about?
At the outset, you started to make the case for keeping the founder in the role.
Yep.
And then you had that dynamic of tension between the investor and the founder. And the supporting argument to me was going to turn on, look, we need to both get in line with each other because it is in your best interest too, because you'll get more value at the end of the day.
I think one of the issues for private equity is that they are financially oriented, and they often don't understand the founder's mentality about insurgency. Mm-hmm. They don't. The founder wants to be the insurgent. They love to be the insurgent. They love to be the one to get to make the. The issue is how do you scale up, and will the founder? The challenge for the private equity partner is to say, I love your attitude, I love your passion and your dedication, and I want to keep that. At the same time, we got to keep that and scale up. How do we balance that? What I'm finding often is the private equity partners don't understand that passion. And they think the excitement of growth and profitability in of itself will overcome the culture, and it won't. You got to keep both. Apple did a very good job under Steve Jobs of constantly scaling up and still portraying itself as an insurgent, even when it wasn't.
Well,
Well, I think there's also some cross purposes. Private equity is in it for the money. They want returns. Whereas founders are offering in it to change the world.
Yeah.
And if you can't get that aligned correctly, you're in for a world of trouble eventually at some point.
And that's.
If you sign up with Bain, though, you signed up with Bain. You sold equity. You gave away the company. If you don't want that, don't go there. It's kind of hard to
you know. There's another issue that we get into, and let me just, how many of you have ever been in this situation, either on this side of the table or that side of the table? There's a performance evaluation, and the person who's doing the evaluation says, you know, I've observed your behavior, and I don't think you're detail-oriented enough. I don't like your follow-through, and I don't think you're strategic-oriented enough. You really need to work on these things. The person on the receiving end of this conversation says, you don't really understand. I am dealing with these time frames. I'm dealing with this amount of cash. I'm dealing with this amount of political pressure. You don't understand the pressures that I'm on. And while I accept that I did the behaviors that you have observed, I don't accept your conclusions about my. And the other person on the other side says, okay, now I got somebody who's not detail-oriented, not good with follow-through, not good in strategy, and stubborn. How many have ever been on either side of that conversation? Anybody? Okay. Pretty common conversations. What I just described is called the actor-observer effect. And it was developed, first described by a guy named Fritz. I'm blanking on his last name, but it's called the actor-observer effect. And basically what it says is when I, as the actor, do something, I'm acutely aware of the political, financial, and social constraints that force me to act the way I do. You, observing my behavior, you don't see those constraints, or you don't factor them in enough, and so you make attributions about my personality. Now, Fritz Heidegger, who's correct? The answer is we don't know. We just know that there's lack of information on the actor's side and on the observer's side. On the actor's side, the person could be denying his own personality and could be, you know, rationalizing things. That happens. The observer doesn't really understand the issues. One of the things in the case here is it gets into Sherry's expressed her concern that he's passive aggressive. And again, could be that's a personality attribution. We try to intervene every time a private equity person starts using personality descriptions. Because that's really kind of a code. If I say, you know, you're doing this because of these constraints, okay, then I say, okay, you're behaving because of, you're responding to the conditions, therefore there's some hope that we can change the conditions and therefore change your behavior. Or if we change the compensation system, maybe we'll change your behavior. But once I make a personality thing, you're passive aggressive. There's no hope for you. I can't change your compensation. It's not going to do anything. Once you make a personality attribution, it's over. Because people don't think, and most people are right, that you can change personality. And you're a psychologist. You know, it's not that easy, right?
You can change behavior, but you can't change personality. And what you're talking about is also attributional theory.
That's exactly what it is, yeah.
Which we tend to look at other people in terms of their personality, we tend to look at ourselves in terms of our behavior, and so there's a regular bias in terms of what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's called attribution theory, and a part of our role in working with companies is to have both sides sensitive to the fact that there's a systematic bias of attribution. You could see the same behavior, but then the attribution is going to be different. And we try to work with partners in terms of having them open to the possibility that maybe it's not personality, but it's some environmental issues that you're not taking into account. Because once the partner starts making personality attributions, it's over. Any questions, comments, issues?
So the correct answer was hire Larry?
It was correct. Yeah, this was the team that got it right.
Just check.
Head of the class, Brian.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Next month, we will be having another case, and the focus is going to be on the Compensation Committee of the Board of Directors. Thank you.
Thank you.